Conference Committee on House Bill 414 to order. And there are three areas that we differed in the, from the House in the Senate version. And if we turn to the last page in the Senate version, under the definition of parent, we added step-parent. And I don't think there's any objection to that particular amendment. Are the members comfortable with that change?
Mr. Chairman, you're just suggesting that we take the Senate language on lines 24 through 26?
Take the Senate language.
This is what he spoke about. Mm-hmm.
Hearing no objection, then we will adopt the Senate language. The other two areas that are different is, are in Section 1 and Section 2, the first being the House had the language dealing with probable cause defined it, and the wisdom of the Senate removed that.
I'd just like an explanation as to the intent of that language, Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Are you talking about Section 1? The intent in the House version, Senator, was to define a probable cause on line 9. You see, in the language that you have in the Senate version, which is what we originally had in the version that came out of the House Judiciary Committee, didn't define probable cause, and a number of representatives said, well, probable cause defined what? So we simply listed probable cause, and we listed it to be as specific in A, B, or C as possible to deal with a person who has in the past or currently or in the future either been a perpetrator, a victim, or a witness to a felony or misdemeanor. So we would cover the waterfront. And then on lines 2 and 3, if there'd be probable cause to find that the health or safety of the minor was in danger, is in danger. And number 3, the intent of the bill basically is to allow a finding of probable cause solely on the fact that the minor's parent had consented in good faith to the interception of the communication based upon the parent's objectively reasonable belief that it was necessary for the welfare of the minor and was in the best interest of the minor. So we just set it out.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you have the language in sub 3 on page 2, line 3, basically the good faith consent to the interception, why do you need the other instances? And I guess that's my first question, is why do you need those?
The reason was so that it would be specifically set out exactly what we were looking at for probable cause, and it was to be as complete as possible. We're not just talking about a probable cause that would be a good idea or something, but that there was criminal activity involved or that the health or safety of the minor was in danger.
Senator French.
Well, just as an example, I mean, I'm not sure which way this argument cuts, but it's at least worth pointing out that on page 1, line 11, it says a party to private communication has committed a misdemeanor, right? That you could read it that way. So sure. Any person that ever committed a misdemeanor would be subject to a wiretap by a parent.
I mean, that's certainly not the intent. We're dealing with a criminal prosecution. That was the intent, to deal with the criminal prosecution of that crime.
Well, I mean, but it says has committed, it says the court may enter the order if the court has probable cause to believe that a party to the private communication has committed a misdemeanor.
But
and there's
that,
no time.
I don't think any judge would say just because at some point the person had shoplifted 20 years in the past, I'm going to allow a wiretap. They're talking about a criminal investigation. I don't think
Professor McGuire.
Well, and I just kind of want to follow this line of discussion from the two lawyers here, because I guess my whole, I'm going to follow the lead of my chairman here. It's his bill. With all due respect, I guess my concern was that we might have raised the threshold a little too high in our committee. And, you know, again, I think this is an issue of parental rights. And I guess, you know, I'd just like to continue to follow the discussion. I'm not so sure that we want such a high threshold, so I guess that would be my only concern.
Thank you. Dean, do you want to make any comments on Section 1 dealing with probable cause? I know we had talked about this.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Dean Guinelli, Chief Assistant Attorney General with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I think there certainly is some value to being specific about what probable cause means. As Representative Grunberg indicated, probable cause as to what. And so having some specific criteria for the court to follow in issuing an order, I think, is a good idea. I certainly do see Senator French's point about has it been opened up, has the door been opened a little wide, if you're talking about a misdemeanor crime committed sometime in the past. I think the court is certainly going to apply some common sense to these matters, and would only issue an order if there is some reason to believe that there is going to be evidence of a crime disclosed during this conversation. So if there's something that has happened, you know, too far remotely in the past, I don't think the court is going to have some basis for believing that there's going to be evidence disclosed during the conversation. So having said that, I think the courts would apply some reasonableness to this. On the other hand, I do see Senator French's point that the language is a bit broad.
Yes.
And just, if I might, Mr. Chairman, on that point, I mean, there's a way to interpret one being more broad and one being more narrow. I guess what I was speaking to is I actually think that Representative Gruenberg's is more narrow in the sense that, first of all, you have to have a finding of probable cause as opposed to a good faith, objectively reasonable belief. And that was where my concern was. But then I think he narrows it at the bottom. So I could be reading it wrong, but I actually think the Senate version is more open, is more broad. But I understand what Senator French was saying, that when you're looking at the narrow part of Rep. Gruenberg's amendment, where you're going back to just to the different crimes, that, you know, how far do you go back and so on. But I think, I mean, what I want to try to discuss is how far do we want to go? How far open do we want to leave it? Do we want probable cause? Do we want the good faith and objectively reasonable belief?
Senator French?
Maybe more broadly, just Mr. Guinelli, this is a question I think for you. We don't want to lose sight of what the bill's about. The bill's about, you know, giving parents the opportunity and the right, if you will, to listen in on conversations that their children are participating in when they have reason to believe their children are engaged in something that might be of danger to them. And so I think it might be just helpful if Mr. Guinelli would point out for us the difference, because I think there was some confusion maybe about this in our committee, about the difference between eavesdropping and wiretapping, and maybe point out where in the bill those two are, if they're handled differently, and if so, where in the bill they're handled differently.
Mr. Chairman, without taking time to pull out the statutes and look up the precise definitions, eavesdropping is generally committed by picking up a receiver on when you've got multiple phone extensions in your house, and that's probably the primary way that people eavesdrop. But our eavesdropping statute also talks about recording using a simple tape recorder to record somebody's conversation without their knowledge. So I think those are the two primary ways in which people eavesdrop. Wiretapping, on the other hand, is not simply a matter of, you know, lifting up a receiver, but it's actually going into the, usually into the phone company's equipment, attaching a tap on the wire, recording anything, potentially having the potential of recording any conversation that goes across the phone. And it's not simply a matter of picking up the receiver or turning on a tape recorder. The federal law and the state law puts a lot of restrictions on wiretapping. There have to be mechanisms in place for, you know, determining, you know, immediately who is talking and the subject matter they're talking about. If it's not within the scope of the wiretapping warrant, they have to hang up. There has to be, you know, recording. So there are a lot of restrictions on an actual wiretapping situation, and it's always been viewed as, you know, potentially much more far-reaching and dangerous practice than simply, you know, picking up a line or a party line.
And Mr. Guarnelli, on page one of the conference working document, when it says, when the statute says, you know, an ex parte order authorizing the interception of the private communication, do you take that to be an eavesdrop or a wiretap or both?
Through the chair, the statute in which this is going, 1237.030, those are the wiretapping statutes. So, I mean, I've always distinguished these two situations as being the wiretapping situation is generally not something that a parent can do on their own. It's something that, you know, it's going to require a judicial order. It is probably something that a police agency is going to do under judicial supervision. Often it is done with the cooperation of a phone company, and it's a major operation. It's generally done by a third party who's not a parent. It may be done with the consent of the parent, but it's done by somebody else. The eavesdropping situation is quintessentially something that parents can do by picking up receivers, by turning on tape recorders, by getting into email and reading it, that sort of thing. So I think that's the difference.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last question on the subject. Is there anything in law right now that prevents a parent, since the parent is not a government agent, you know, presumably, you know, setting aside those rare instances where the parent is acting as a government agent, the parent's just acting as a concerned parent, is there anything that prevents that parent from eavesdropping or indeed even recording through the use of maybe a message machine, recording the conversations that his or her child is engaged in?
Through the chair, I think that's the whole purpose of this bill, is to exempt parental actions that would violate the prohibitions on eavesdropping. The prohibitions on eavesdropping in state law do not contain an exemption for parents. They're fairly broad, and this bill does contain that exemption.
So just so I'm real clear, the exemption, and I think now we're talking about the exception on page 3, lines 20 through 27, that is an exception that takes place without a court order. And so that's where we're talking about eavesdropping or home recording or any other sort of private parental gathering of communications that the minor's been engaged in.
That's correct. The exception occurs in the eavesdropping statutes, the things that parents can easily do in the context of their what goes on in their home and in monitoring what their children are doing and saying. The eavesdropping situation is, or the wiretapping situation is, something else. Again, it's ordinarily a police operation.
So even though a parent's not a government agent, they're breaking the law by eavesdropping on a minor's communications.
They are not only breaking the law, they're subject to potential criminal prosecution. Under current existing Alaska law, it is a crime to eavesdrop. That's set out in the statutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Seekins.
So now this would allow interception, as the statute here says on line 20. So that would mean being able to print off emails, put an automatic recording device on a home telephone, intercept that, and retain that communication. And use it in a court proceeding as long as it was done by the parent for the best interest and the of the child.
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, that's correct. The interception of the communication is the phrase used in the statutes. It's given kind of the shorthand phrase of eavesdropping. The existing statutes cover, there's a definition of wire communications, there's a definition of oral communication, there's a definition of electronic communication. All of those cover everything that you mentioned.
There's nothing in law that would prohibit a parent from tape recording an oral communication back and forth with the child or with anyone else.
Actually, tape recording oral conversations is without the consent of one of the parties to the conversation is something that is prohibited.
Mm-hmm. By state law?
By state law.
Yeah.
Representative Grunberg.
I thought that the prohibition, if there was one, Dean, would have been in 4220.320. But I thought that only covered wire communications. I didn't think there was anything in state law that would prohibit me from, when I'm talking to Daniel or whoever, my child, from just putting a tape recorder there. Is there something that says I can't do that?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, if you were a party to that conversation, you're entitled to record it.
Yeah.
If you were not a party to the conversation.
Correct.
But, okay,
that's what I was getting to.
Through the chair, let's say my child is talking to somebody else. Is there something in the law that says I can't put a tape recorder? They're just in the same room.
Yes, I believe.
But under this law, you could do that.
Either version of the bills, it would be an exception for parents to do that.
Right.
That's not by law.
But I can always record my own conversation with anybody without their knowledge.
That's correct. Alaska is considered a one-party consent state. As long as one party of the conversation consents, that's sufficient.
Max,
maybe I'm wrong, but the Fourth Amendment I thought only applied to governmental activity, and if it's a solely private person, and there's no wire or anything like that, I thought that there's not. Is there a statute or something that says there is?
There is, and that's what it is part of these statutes in Title 42.
Oh, it is.
It covers. So it's a matter of statutory law.
I didn't know that.
And you know, the issue that courts have struggled with all across the country is whether, and I think our statutes are consistent with a lot of statutes in the country, and is whether these statutes were ever intended to apply to parents. And a lot of courts rule that, you know, even though there's no explicit exception for parental recording, parental, you know, eavesdropping, that the statutes really were never intended to do that. Other courts rule that it's not so clear, and so this bill attempts to clarify that in terms of Alaska.
Mr. Chair, I didn't know that there was another statute on the subject, and this particular section, and I'm not an expert on this, I thought 320, and I'm looking at Section 2 of the bill now, only applied to electronic kinds of communications. If you, as the sponsor of the bill, were intending to prohibit, to allow a parent to listen in on, you know, just in a room to sit, you know, with a window open or sit in the closet or have a tape recorder, maybe we should be looking at another statute too. I don't know. I wasn't aware of that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Seekins.
I think it was my intent all along that the parent be able to intercept any kind of communication, and for what, as long as it was in the best interest and welfare of the child, and I do believe this does that, but maybe am I correct?
Either version of the bill does that. Either version of the bill creates an exemption for parents for all of the typical conduct that they might want to engage in. So I think we are covered. I think the fundamental difference is the admissibility of that information in a court of law in a civil or criminal proceeding. And that hasn't been discussed yet, but that to me is the fundamental difference.
And just to move matters along, again, we have still two differences between the versions, and one deals with the probable cause, and we kind of strayed into the second area, which is the evidentiary aspect of this. But at this point, if we can just focus in on the probable cause aspect, we can at least dispense with that one and then move on to the next one, which is another complex issue. Senator Huggins?
Chairman, just for the record, I am in favor of dispensing with probable cause, have it removed, that too high threshold.
I didn't hear.
Say again?
I didn't hear what you said.
Yeah, dispense with probable cause. I'm just going on the record at that position.
He's concerned about it being too high of a threshold. I'd like to hear some more discussion, Mr. Chairman, on the subject. I, you know, in our committee, you guys, what we got wrapped around the axle on was the circumstance. I mean, we talked about you do sometimes have a circumstance where you might have a parent who is looking out for the best interest of their child, quote unquote, and ends up pitted directly against their kid. So there was that discussion. For example, they overhear their kid involved in an illegal activity. So we talked about that. We also talked about the abusive parent situation, where you might have a parent that has a different motivation and therefore isn't forming that good faith belief. So we talked about that. But I am concerned about it being, I am a little concerned about the threshold. For the case where you really do want to overhear the bad stuff going on and ultimately want to use that evidence in a court of law. And so I'd like to hear some discussion.
You got to remember, the ex parte order is governmental directed. Dean?
Mr. Chairman, I think that we've got to, when we're talking about wiretapping, as you indicate, essentially this is going to be a police action, judicial supervision. This is, in a sense, a type of search warrant. And because it is a type of search warrant, the court is going to apply a probable cause standard in some way, shape, or form. I think it in essence becomes a Fourth Amendment search.
That's right.
And so the real question is how much legislative guidance is going to be provided to the courts as to exactly what kinds of factors they're going to be looking at under the probable cause. And so, to that extent, I think that the House formulation of it is good in that it sets out a number of factors, and to me the only question was whether the allowing it to be done based on a past commission of a misdemeanor crime is too broad. If you think about it though, if you're thinking about a regular search warrant, ordinarily the police have to show that there's probable cause that a crime has been committed and that there's evidence of the crime that will be found in that location. I think as I said, the courts apply generally some notion of recency of that crime. I mean, I don't think that you're going to be able to get a search warrant, unless it's a cold case situation, there's something new that's come up. But, a misdemeanor that was committed 2 years ago and all of a sudden, I think the court is going to ask some very hard questions about, what has occurred now that's going to give you some reason to believe there's evidence of that crime still there. So I think the courts are kind of used to dealing with these kinds of situations about recent crimes or not so recent crimes. So I'm not terribly troubled by this formulation, and I think it gives the courts good guidance in terms of what they need to look for in terms of probable cause.
Senator Seekins?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a problem with the has committed, has been, or has been in there, because from my perspective, there may have been a murder committed, and maybe the reason here to intercept that private communication is to get evidence or conversations about the murder that has been committed. It's already been committed. It's in the past. The crime has been committed. And the communication is there to try to hear the person talk about having committed the crime or along that line. So, I don't have maybe as big a concern as Senator French would have, although it does open the door to being able to almost But I think the court would have pretty good discretion on it, as to, you just can't record somebody's conversation because they've been convicted of a misdemeanor sometime in their past history. There would have to be some nexus, I think, to some recent crime or the outstanding crime or potential crime that is in the process. But I wouldn't think that. But I don't have a problem with that. I've got examples of a court order that allowed the tape recording of two minors, and it was on a murder case. The murder had been committed. And it was, so in that case, I think it'd be covered under the has committed a portion of it, and I wouldn't want to eliminate that.
Representative Grunberg.
You know, when we drafted this, Mr. Chair, we didn't put something in that is sometimes, and Dean, I don't know where, I'm thinking it's in another statute. There's another subsection after these things that says that the evidence that is obtained or sought to be obtained from the search, in this case the tab, will be relevant in the prosecution for a crime or something like that if there's a crime involved. And I've seen a statute like that somewhere that lays it out, and I just was thinking that was just assumed in here, and if anybody had a problem, because we're not talking about wanting to tap a conversation just because a person had a shoplifting conversation 20 years in the past. We're dealing with a situation where if there's a crime that's been committed, the tap would be involved in the prosecution of that crime. And I don't have a problem if you wanted to add something like that in, but I thought that was assumed. But isn't there a statute or something that...
Through the Chair, Representative Grunberg, certainly the evidence rules that the court applies require the court to determine that the evidence is reliable, relevant, reliable, and more probative than prejudicial. So there are certainly things that the courts always look at as an initial threshold matter before they decide whether evidence will come into court. But I think Senator Seekin's term is a good one. I mean, there's got to be some nexus, some connection between, you know, the crime that you believe was committed and the, you know, securing some evidence. I mean, that's why we issue search warrants. And so although this sets out probable cause and some specifications, there are going to be additional things that the court's going to look at. The court's going to look at, you know, do you have probable cause to believe that there's actually going to, you know, be a conversation that will be relevant to that offense. The court is going to look at, you know, the when you want to do this, how long the wiretapping will be in place. The court is going to impose some restrictions on that. I mean, you just can't do it forever. There are going to be some very specific restrictions. So I think you've covered the important points the court ought to look at, but there are going to be a lot of other hoops that you're going to have to go through before you actually get a full order. That's because there are a whole lot of protections built into this, because it is a very significant power of the government to actually, you know, tap the phones of this country.
Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, you know, part of the reason that I guess when we went back to the former House Judiciary version was our primary consideration, I think, I'm not trying to speak for the other members of our Judiciary Committee, but three of the five are here on this, and they can speak for themselves, was primarily covered under subparagraphs 2 and 3 on page 2, the first five lines. That was our primary concern, I believe. It was for the health or safety of the minor or the parent, or that they, you know, again, that it was in the welfare for the minor and the best interest of the minor. That was our primary concern that we were trying to address. So we think that we did that, but I don't necessarily know if there's any damage or any harm to the rest of the language.
Representative Bloomberg.
Mr. Chair, the reason I had suggested putting in the first subsection here is because it is not common, but it does sometimes occur, for example, that a minor would witness a crime. There's a case, an early case called McBride, where a person was convicted, I think one parent murdered another, something like that, and the main witness to this was a five-year-old child, and the court held in that case she was not too young to testify, and they affirmed. So it might be a circumstance where a child was a witness, or the other person on the line was a witness and discussing it with the child, or it's conceivable that one of them was a perpetrator, not having anything to do necessarily with the child's welfare. But, you know, a parent could be saying to a child, I just committed securities fraud or something like that, and that child and that conversation would be key. And in fact, a court might very well, because of the age of the child, prefer to admit the tape as an admission or something, and so the child would be kept off the stand. There might be some reason for using that. That's what my thinking was.
Can we go off the record for a minute?
You bet. Taking at ease.
I can, Mr. Chairman. I'm only concerned about one other word. It's on line 7. It's the word only. The court may enter the order only if the court determines. I would prefer that that word only not be in the text, that I allow it to be permissive rather than restrictive.
By the way, two things. You realize that in the House version, the language on the good faith interception and the health, that's all. At the top of page 2. The word only, as I recall, and you'd remember this, Liesl, is, I believe I offered that in committee, and the reason for that, and it's not all necessarily that important, but I think my thinking was that I wanted the court to find probable cause before issuing the warrant.
That's true. This is the rub for me, and my apologies to everyone, because I started the beginning of the meeting going way back in time to my original philosophical thoughts on the bill. Here we are today. I don't disagree, but you know, I think that the concerns
with me or Max?
With you. Respectfully.
No, it's fine. Not me.
I'd like to ask Mr. Vannelli, I'm not sure that we're not splitting hairs once you already have the high threshold of probable cause anyway.
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, I would point out that the word only is in both versions,
yes,
both the Senate and the
right.
House versions.
You'd have to.
I think whether it's there or not, it may not make a difference. I think if it reads the court may enter the order if the court determines, the court is going to say, I've got to determine that's an absolute minimum that I've got to determine, and I'm not certain that the phrase would have significance for a court whether it's there or not. I think they're going to probably skip right over that and say, these are the things I've got to find, and that's what I'm going to do. So I think it's probably okay either way.
Okay. Just wanted to address it. Okay.
Just a final thought, Mr. Chairman, would be just to keep the communication up on the subject that you have great interest in, and I know your staff does, that to make sure we get it right, and that maybe there are circumstances that will arise in the future that we've been too narrow on, and we need to come back and revisit it. Yeah, so I think this is a good shot at it now, and we've given a really clear direction to the court. I just, as I said before, my only concern on only is that I think we are splitting hairs. The threshold of probable cause is so high, and we've given such clear direction. I think they'd interpret it, but I just keep thinking of these circumstances where, you know, you overhear this conversation that is, you know, really a threat to your child, and you've got these high thresholds, and you can't get it admitted, and it just devastates me. But here we are, so let's move forward, and maybe we can come back and revisit it in the years to come if we need to.
Okay, is there any further discussion on Section 1 of the bill? Is there any objection to taking the House language?
Do we procedurally, Mr. Chairman, have to reject, each body reject the others, and then work on the amended version?
I think we can handle it a number of ways. We can do that, or just adopt one version or the other. Right. You know, language in either the House or the Senate version. Or if we want to modify it, we can modify it.
Well, we do have a House version, we have the Senate version, and we have a suggested conference version, which I'm, at this point, have no objection with the conference version, just trying now to determine the procedural methodology here so that we make sure that we're able to present this in the last part of the session.
If we just take the House and the Senate version and work from those two rather than to address the conference suggested language.
Okay.
Then, without any objection, then we'll adopt the House version of Section 1 of the bill.
Right.
Okay. Got through that. The next area that there's a difference is in Section 2, and that deals with the evidentiary aspect of allowing whatever is obtained in the courts. Dean, do you want to open up the comments on this section, which seems to be the more controversial aspect of the bill? I mean, it's more philosophical. I think Max makes a good argument, but you also make a very good argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I would, and I'll try to be brief. First of all, let me state that there was I attended a meeting in your office on Saturday, I think it was, with Representative Gruenberg, and we talked for, you know, about an hour about this. You know, this primarily this particular provision, and I certainly respect his views as a practitioner in family law, a longtime practitioner. He knows a lot about that area, you know, he makes it very clear it's a very emotional area of the law. It's difficult for the parties. The cases are often acrimonious, and I think it's, I hate to say it, but it's almost inherently in the nature of the practice. Divorces and child custody matters get very emotional, and I applaud him for dealing in that area of the law. I'm not certain that I would have the stomach for it, frankly. But I think he and I may have a disagreement on the philosophy behind this particular provision. And let me see if I can articulate it. generally. The court of law is a fact-finding process, and the judges try to base their decisions on, or juries, on all, you know, relevant, reliable, and probative evidence. In certain types of situations, there may be other reasons for not basing judicial decisions on all the relevant evidence, and the primary one is when the court suppresses evidence, and suppresses evidence ordinarily when the police have done something wrong in a criminal case. It's a very extreme remedy. We often have rapes and murders that cannot be prosecuted, or that we lose simply because some critical piece of evidence, a murder weapon, for example, that the police thought they saw in plain view, but the court decided otherwise, or they exceeded the scope of the warrant and seized something, and it's not allowed to be admitted into evidence. We allow that to occur, And as I think it was Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, we allow the criminal to go free because the constable has blundered for a very important reason, and that is to, and the underlying purpose of the exclusionary rule is to deter police misconduct. That is the purpose, and it really is effective in doing that. I mean, the police are not going to. I mean, if they know that this evidence is going to be thrown out, they're not gonna just grab it. They're gonna contact the DA. They're gonna get a search warrant. They're gonna try to do it right. But it is, you know, it is an extraordinary remedy, and it is effective. And the reason why we are willing to let some criminals go free is because the consequence of not doing so is arguably to allow government agents, police officers with the full power of the government, to engage in conduct that violates the Constitution. And there really is no effective way to govern that, to prevent that from occurring, other than suppression of the evidence, at least so far as the courts have been able to structure. So we do that to prevent governmental abuses of constitutional rights. Now, in this kind of situation, what the House version does is it essentially suppresses what presumably is relevant, reliable, and probative evidence, not because some government agent has violated somebody's constitutional rights, but because a private party in a inherently acrimonious situation has not intercepted, has not picked up the phone receiver or read the email or turned on the tape recorder in the specific way that this requires. What the House version requires is that the parent have acted in good faith and in the belief that this interception was necessary to essentially to protect the child. The parent may simply be curious. The parent may not have any specific information that something is going on, but you know, her or his antenna are up. They may pick up the phone for that reason. They may pick up the phone or read the email inadvertently. Those kinds of situations would not fall under this exception, and any relevant evidence would be suppressed. What we may end up doing is suppressing evidence of the sexual abuse of that child in a criminal case, even if it doesn't result in possibly criminal conduct. What we are saying to the judge in a child custody situation is, don't consider that evidence that was intercepted. That may be the single key point of evidence that would tip the judge's decision, but we are saying, don't consider that because the evidence was obtained inadvertently, or because the mother did it out of mere curiosity, or maybe the mother just wanted to dig up dirt on the father. But if that is relevant, reliable, and probative information that a court ought to consider, then one has to ask, why are we prohibiting the court from considering it? What governmental interest are we furthering? In the police misconduct situation, we are trying to deter police actions that violate the constitutional rights of citizens. When we're dealing with parents in an inherently emotional and acrimonious situation, do we really think that we are going to get them to like each other any better? Do we really think that we are going to get them to, you know, act the way that we would all hope that we would act? These are emotional situations. That parents are going to act in ways that may not fit within the narrow confines of the statute. And if they do, and if something turns up that a court ought to consider, my view is, at least, the court ought to be allowed to consider that, and it shouldn't be simply suppressed. So that's my argument. It kind of goes back to what Representative Gruenberg was saying a while ago about, you know, doesn't the Fourth Amendment really prohibit, you know, government actions and not actions of private individuals? The answer is yes, and I think that this ought to reflect that same underlying principle, that we want to control the actions of government agents that violate the rights of citizens, and let the courts determine the best interest of the child based on all the available and relevant evidence. So that's my pitch, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Dean. Are there questions for Dean?
Do you wish me to give my view on this? We heard a lot of testimony in House Judiciary from a number of family law practitioners whom I invited to testify, because I think our experience has been quite similar. The instance where this would become a key issue in a criminal case, I think, is fairly rare. It would become an issue in a number of custody cases, a large, not an overwhelming number, but a fair number of custody cases on a regular basis. Because people would be listening in the context of a divorce or a custody to get information that they could use against the other parent in court. I don't have any problem with parents, for legitimately listening in on their telephone conversations of the children as part of a normal parent's duty. The thing is that in divorces, as John Reese, just Superior Court judge, says, people get crazy, and that's regular. I think that Hollis asked, I don't know if I'm quoting directly, Hollis, clerk for Judge Reese many years ago, but he said that on a number of occasions, and the practice would be for good divorce lawyers in these kinds of cases to suggest to their clients, not necessarily regularly, but more than is happening now, to tap the phone or listen in, not just to find out what's going on, but because the fear would be the other side is doing it, and they will selectively try to introduce evidence of those calls. The issue that this would be used more often than not has nothing to do with criminal law. The statute for custody in the divorce, and in any case, says the court must look at the love and affection existing between the child and the one parent. And another factor is the other parent's willingness to foster an open and loving, frequent relationship with the other parent and the child. And the purpose of these calls would be to gather information on issues. This would be how a conversation would go. The child would say, "Gee, Mom, I really want to live with you rather than Dad. Why, honey? Because he's mean, he makes me do my homework, he doesn't like my friends, et cetera, et cetera." And this would go back and forth on whether the one parent was trying to influence the child against the other parent. And it would become, in a number of cases, we family practitioners feel, a weapon to be used in the court. Would put the child in a very private type of telephone conversation right smack in the middle of these cases, where the child was maybe not intending to be, didn't even know was being, and that's frankly why they don't in this state have children testify in court, why they don't interview children in chambers, why they use custody investigators and guardians ad litem to take the kids out of this. And this would put the kid through these tapped telephone conversations right smack in the middle of these cases. The admission of evidence in court is discretionary, and whether the trial judge admits a piece of evidence or denies its admission will not be overturned unless an abuse of discretion is found, and that means that there's a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made. This doesn't amend the rules of evidence. So the discretionary nature of the admission is still in ultimately the court's decision. This simply provides guidance, and it requires that before the evidence is admitted, one party may object. And if that person raises an objection, the court must rule that it is admissible. And these are the factors the court can consider.
Senator Seekins.
When I read 422310, it basically says a person may not use an eavesdropping device to hear or record all or any part of an oral conversation without the consent of a party to the conversation, without the consent of a party, the single party rule. And in this section, eavesdropping device means any device capable of being used to hear or record oral conversation, whether the conversation is conducted in person, by telephone, or by other means, provided this does not include devices for the restoration of the deaf. Later, there's a different definition under 390 that is more expansive on an eavesdropping device, but in this section, it appears to me that if a parent picked up the phone and heard it on the telephone, that they have violated the law. And they listened in. It doesn't use the expansive definition that's contained later in 390. It says in this section, it's any instrument, which would include an extension telephone. And mm-hmm. So it appears to me that we got a problem here. I know what you're saying, Max. You know, I've seen those bitter divorces, too, and I've seen all the child custody disputes I ever want to see in my life. I don't want to see anymore, and I'm glad that there are people like you out there who work through those things. But I wouldn't want to be one of them. But here, I'm interested in protecting the welfare of the child and the best interest of the child. And so I'm more in favor of the definition that's in the Senate version, because I think it allows that in a more unimpeded way for parents to be able to get that information without having to first step through the hoops that are there in the House version. And I understand what you're saying, and it could be used in a very mean, nasty way. I have no doubt. I've seen that happen. But for the benefit of the child, I don't want to step through these hoops. I would prefer the Senate version. And I know that there's some garbage that can come with that. But the good that I think that comes with it far outweighs the potential for the garbage.
Mr. McGuire.
Just a couple comments. The first would be that the discretion of the judge can go both ways. And what I would submit is the good judges would be able to see through this. And I would hope that they wouldn't allow their courtroom to become a three-ring circus. And so I would, with all due respect, lean the direction of the senator. We went back and forth in our committee on this, and it's a question of, you know, what side you err on. I would hope the discretion would work the other way, too. Hope that good judges would see through it. And then the other thing is, I think the responsibility also rests with the family law bar. And I don't know that, you know, people who are out there involved in custody disputes are sitting there watching what we do every day and saying, aha, a new law has passed and I've got a new tool. So I think a lot of the ethics rests with the family law bar and how they conduct themselves and how they instruct their clients. And it sounds like that's where I think your concern lies with, is that you're going to have family law lawyers encouraging their clients to tape record their children's conversations in an effort to try to garner a superior position. I would hope that wouldn't occur, and I would hope that judges would use their discretion. I will ultimately go with the will of this conference committee, but I did want to put those comments on the record. My concern from the beginning, as I echoed, is those circumstances where you overhear a really bad situation on the phone that would result in a criminal charge, and you ultimately cannot get that entered into evidence because we've crafted this language in such a way that we're so worried about all these other things. And, you know, I really want to put the parents back in control, and really in the lives of you know, being able to do something about these circumstances. So, but I'm very respectful to you, Max, and I know you've spent a lot of time practicing in this area, and God bless you for doing it.
Well, if I may, right now, some judges let this in and some don't. It's a pretty unclear area of the law. I've had judges admit it, and I've heard, I can think of one case where they did admit it, and they said, well, if this is illegal, you have a remedy, you can try to criminally prosecute the other side, because we wanted to admit it. But I know that in some states, these people are so acrimonious that after the custody, they try to prosecute the other person for violating the federal wiretap law. And the circuits go both ways. These go up to the circuits. So, I mean, you know, these cases, in some cases, there's the underlying divorce or custody case, usually divorce. Then there may be a fraudulent transfer case. There may be criminal prosecutions. There may be subsequent child in need of aid proceedings brought. These people are really pretty vicious in some cases. And it's unclear now. And I'm concerned that if we take the Senate version, which was the House Judiciary version, and I'm not saying that what we came up with in rules necessarily is without flaw, but I think that the courts will feel that these communications can routinely be taken place, that people can go around tapping and using them in the family law cases. Yeah.
Senator French.
Thank you. I think we all recognize this is a very difficult decision. I mean, it really is. And as I look at the two languages between the conference version and the Senate version, you know, I see that the conference version would exclude inadvertent evidence where the parent just picks up the telephone and happens to hear something terrible, whereas the Senate version would allow the inclusion or the admission of evidence gathered in bad faith. And so that's what I'm trying to weigh out.
I didn't intend that. I'm talking about...
I said the Senate version would allow... I mean, at least that's what I understood you to say, is that the Senate version, without the hoops, if you will, of the conference version, would allow the admission into evidence of bad evidence gathered in bad faith, the offensive sort of examples that you gave.
Yeah, those are the ones I was trying to get at.
Right.
Not the inadvertent.
I understand. And I guess as I weigh it out, I think... At least at one level, the protection of the child will take place. Either way, the parent gets the evidence. If you're really worried about, you know, a predator or something terrible happened, once the parent learns of it, no matter how he or she learns of it, if it's a real parent, they'll take the steps necessary to safe out the situation. So at one level, I guess I'm less concerned about, you know, protection of the child, and I think we're more talking about what sort of evidence gets admitted in court. And I'm leaning towards the conference version, I guess with the caveat that we can come back and fix it if it turns out that we're making a mistake. And I guess what tips me towards the conference version is that inadvertent evidence, I think a judge will find a way to admit. I think a judge will find a way to admit relevant, probative, evidence whose only, I guess, missing link is that the parent just didn't have any belief about whether it was necessary. The parent just simply stumbled upon it. My feeling is that if the parent stumbled on a piece of evidence, he or she would then have an objectively reasonable belief that it's necessary to gather a little bit more evidence that would wind up making the case.
But it's a very tough call.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bloomberg.
You know, and it might be necessary to broaden our powers a little bit. I wouldn't have any problem in taking a little bit of time, if we had it, to try to craft any language that would eliminate the inadvertent issue, because I believe, you know, wasn't my intent to create that problem. And maybe we could come up with something fairly quickly. I don't know. You're shaking your head, Senator.
You're not.
Mr. McGuire.
No, I don't think you're tracking Senator French's comments. I think what he's saying is that the part that's appealing about your language that you put in rules is that it excludes that inadvertent, potentially bad faith.
I see. Okay.
So I don't think that there's a fix needed there. I think the question is what side you err on. So I think he was actually supporting you.
No, I knew that. No, I absolutely knew that. And I was saying if there was something we could do to make Senator Seekins feel a little more comfortable. No, I knew that.
I don't think there's a middle ground. I mean, I think the issue is you either say it's the inadvertent, it's all of it, or you say it's got to be the narrow, good faith, objectively reasonable belief. And I think that's been the thing that's the thing we struggled with in our committee. And that's the reason that you ultimately put the fix in rules. It's very difficult.
Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I could conceivably do exactly the same thing that we talk about recording conversations between the non-custodial parent and the child, because of believing that the non-custodial parent is trying to, you know, create a situation that is not in the best interest of the child as well. You know, parents can be terribly manipulative too, and being manipulative is not necessarily in the best interest of the child. And trying to line that child up on one side or the other of a divorce action or a custody dispute. But what I absolutely don't want to have happen is I'm a grandparent now, but you know, I don't want to happen is a parent pick up that telephone and hear a conversation. That conversation may only take place one time, and they be able to somehow or another record or document that conversation, that for any reason whatsoever, that instantaneous, without a prior objectively reasonable belief that it was necessary for them to do so, that they could not use that in the protection of the child, for the best interest of the child. So I guess part of my question is, when does a parent believe that there is a reasonable belief? When, in good faith, does a parent have a reasonable belief that it's necessary to be able to intercept that? And is an inadvertent interception going to be thrown out by the court? That's my concern. I don't want to see that happen.
Thanks.
We talked about this on the weekend when we had our informal discussion. I believe that if there is a criminal situation where that somebody picks up the phone and is acting, you know, generally in good faith, and they overhear something like this, the court is going to admit it. They are going to err on the side of protecting the child and prosecuting for the crime. I do not think that will be a problem. What we're trying to prevent is just this vicious stuff that goes on in divorces where they're going to try to put the kid in the middle. We're not dealing with a legitimate criminal prosecution here. I don't think that that's going to exclude anything.
Mr. Chairman, I have a thought, and I don't, I'm just throwing that out there. It's late in the game. What if you were to say in sub 9, what if you were to keep it the way that we had it in judiciary, in both Senate and House, and leave it open without the threshold of good faith and objectively reasonable belief? Leave it open. That being said, put in an A that, and maybe even a B, that related specific to those child custody cases. So certainly A would be, so A would then read, considered by a guardian ad litem or child custody investigator, only if the guardian ad litem or child custody investigator determines that the parent acted in good faith and had an objectively reasonable belief. So that what you do is you kind of get both things. You allow for the overall broad power, so you catch those cases where somebody maybe has done something truly bad, criminal, that you'd like to be able to use later in a court of law, but that you put a narrower restriction down in the area of child custody.
That would
it's
be
just
acceptable.
A thought.
That would be fine.
And even in a child custody case, if I could, Mr. Chairman, there can be communications between one parent and the child, which the interception of and the presentation of are could be in the best interest of the child.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. Oh, honey, your father just hates me, and you know he doesn't want you to come and see me anymore. You know, and he goes on. There's just tremendous psychological pressure that can be put on
that's
a
what
minor.
I'm trying to avoid getting that stuff in.
Yeah, but what if that took place? Is that not in the best interest of the child to be able to present that in a custody case that the child is being leveraged psychologically, and that could do permanent damage to, even to the child and the relationship between the child and the other parent? I mean, some of that I understand, Max. You don't want it to be there, but some of it would be in the best interest of the child's welfare that it was presented and presentable.
That I didn't have a problem with, because in that case, if that kind of a conversation were intercepted, then the judge would say, you're right, that should come in. That's trying to influence the child. That would come in under the language that Representative McGuire is suggesting, and under this. Absolutely. I just want the judge to make the determination. It doesn't automatically come in.
I wouldn't think that it would under the other one necessarily either. The judge still has the discretion.
Well, this, that would be, the judge would have the discretion, that's true.
I'm just not trying to put as many handcuffs on that judge, maybe, as you are.
I want to eliminate the possible interpretation that a judge would feel they had to let it in. This is a very difficult area to craft legislative language.
Well, I understand that, and I guess I'm leaning more towards allowing the discretion of a judge in a case like this, because it could be very relevant to the welfare of the child.
That's right.
And I would rather err on the side of the welfare of the child than to either party in the dispute being able to protect some kind of information from consideration by the court.
I would like to see, and I would certainly accept conceptually some kind of language like you're suggesting. That's what we were trying to do here, and maybe not very artfully, and that's why we have this committee. So, I mean, I'm with you, I think, on this, and with Representative McGuire. Maybe you can come up with a suggestion. I mean, I like what you're saying. I don't have any problem with that. And that would probably, hopefully, maybe alleviate some of the problems that Mr. Grinnell was.
Well, the broad brush fits me better than the narrow one. That's all I'm saying, because I do understand that, that there could be some abuse there, and I know that it can get ugly. You know, any of us that have lived as long as I have seen the ugliness of some of the situations in life. But my primary concern is for that child, and the interception of a private communication to which that minor is a party by a parent should be exempt from 310, and that's what my concern is, my 300 and 310. And how the court treats that is another matter. And I'm not wanting to try to be able to restrict at this point how the court treats that information. I'm just wanting to allow the parent, under our definition, to be able to intercept that communication without breaking the law.
How about this, if I may make a suggestion? Some language in that would say, let's say we took the Senate language with the following addition, that the admission of this evidence should be in the discretion of the court or something like that. I mean, I don't know.
It's a restatement of a truism that already exists.
I want to be sure that they
I'm
don't
willing to do that, but it's just a restatement statement of a truism that does exist, and I'm depending on.
Well, the reason I'm saying that is I don't want this language to indicate that that must be admitted.
Okay. I understand where you're going, and with your leeway, Mr. Chairman.
Seriously.
I understand where you're going. But let's not lose the focus as to what this bill really is all about. It's to allow parents to legally intercept communications of their minor children. How it's used after that is a different subject, and maybe a different subject for a different bill. But here, what I'm trying to do is to no longer make it a criminal offense for a parent to intercept those communications. Now, whether they're used and how they're used for the best interest of the child at a later point in time, I think is a separate matter, maybe for a separate bill, something we can spend more time on when we're not in the second to the last day of a session, and accomplish what we're doing here, but do it with time for additional thought on how the court can use that information, but not make a parent a criminal if they do intercept. That's all I'm trying to accomplish.
Senator French.
Mr. Chairman, it was a wonderfully refreshing break I had, and I hope I didn't miss anything too substantive. And if this suggestion has been made, forgive me. But I just wonder whether that we couldn't improve the Senate version by simply adding that the interception was made in good faith. And that, I think, takes care of the inadvertent issue. That is, most parents, we assume, are acting in good faith. They pick up the telephone, you're just making a phone call, you hear something terrible, you can now use that evidence as long as it's made in good faith. But it just sort of puts some sideboards, if you will, on the ugly divorces that Representative Grunberg has been bringing to our attention.
I wouldn't have any problem, Mr. Chairman, amending line 9 to say the good faith interception of something along that line, if that'll get us over this hump. And Max and I have had many of these discussions.
Okay. You're talking about taking the Senate version. That would be amending on line 13 of page 3?
Yes.
Yes.
Just say the good faith interception.
Representative McGuire, was that going where you were going?
I think it gets us through the chair. I think it gets us there. I think we all understand the rub, and are matters, discussions of Commerce Committee reports a matter of public record as well?
Yes.
Okay, and so hopefully that's a guiding light, if you will, for a judge interpreting this. I like it. I think it works. I think at this stage of the game, I think it gets us where we want to go. It also truly does prevent the other concern that I brought up, which is the child abuse case. And those are very sad cases, but where you might get a parents not only physically can abuse their children, but sometimes psychologically abuse, and that also gets us out of that area too.
So the language, Mr. Chair, would be the Senate version, but on line 13 it would be, quote, the good faith, unquote, interception.
Yes.
That'd be fine.
Okay.
Did we make a man?
I'll move that amendment.
Hearing no objection, the amendment is adopted, which then we have resolved that section of the bill.
We have caucus.
So with that, then, we will craft the language, get the drafters to put that in the bill. There'll be a conforming title change required. And with that, Dean, do you have any, are we okay, sort of?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've got to say, I hate to interfere with all the good feelings around the committee, but, you know, good faith, maybe that allows the inadvertent picking up the line. What does it do about, you know, just out of curiosity? I'm not exactly sure what good faith really means in this context. You know, the committee spent a lot of time on you know, talking about probable cause, but I kind of know what probable cause is in the search warrant context. Good faith in this kind of context, I'm not sure what that is exactly. I thought what I heard, where I heard things going, was that, you know, language such as, you know, subject to the Alaska rules of evidence, or subject to being, you know, relevant or reliable and probative, something of that sort, I think would be terrific. You know, maybe even not allowing the guardian ad litem to consider it unless it's in the best interest of the minor. I think that would be good. I think good faith injects an uncertain term, and criminal defense attorneys are, you know, who's defending a father charged with, you know, abuse of the child, are going to be arguing forever about whether the mother intercepted that conversation, quote, in good faith. And I'm nervous about that. So, I mean, I guess my thought was, you know, we're going in the right direction if you're talking about subject to the rules of evidence, relevant, reliable, probative, you know, best interest of the minor, things of that sort. I'm nervous about good faith. So I guess that's about all I can say at this point.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I just don't want, because when I read 310, it says 10 years from now, if Representative McGuire picks up that telephone and hears a conversation of her daughter with somebody else, and she listens to it, she's broken the law.
No, that's not what I was talking about. We're talking about only admission in court.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm going to have a daughter next.
I'm going to have another one, aren't you?
Or we haven't had that conversation about where I'm not having any more children. Oh,
yeah. but if you take me back to the...
just teasing.
Don't worry about your boys, just your girls.
I'm kidding. Not me either.
But that, I'm just saying, if we get to that point, that's my primary concern here, is to remove that criminal offense from a parent. Then how we use that is a subject for a different day, I think.
I think that, you know, the problem, one of the problems with the Rules Committee substitute may have been the putting the good faith up on lines 21 and 20. I'm looking at, let's look at the, we can look at the Rules Committee, or let's look at the Rules Committee substitute amended. What we're talking about is that is not necessarily a requirement for the interception of the communication. It's a requirement for the admission in court.
See, and this section says the following activities are exempt from the provisions of AS 4220-300 and 310.
Dean.
Boom. So what we're getting into is, even here, I think at this point the inadvertent interception would still be illegal.
Not the intent. That was not the intent.
But I think it would be.
That's maybe not well drafted.
I guess I'm just going to have to beg to differ. I mean, I just don't see how someone would. I know. Coming at this late date, it's a little bit of a blow. We've been getting along so well, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I could make a suggestion to see how this sits with everyone. Starting with the Senate version, and then following that with, evidence intercepted under this subsection may only be considered by a guardian ad litem or child custody investigator if in the best interest of the minor. So that takes care of them. They will only consider it if it's in the best interest of the minor. And then evidence intercepted under this subsection may be admitted in a judicial proceedings subject to the Alaska Rules of Evidence and in a matter relating to custody of the minor only if in the best interest of the minor. And that makes, for criminal proceedings, that means it's the rules of evidence governed. With civil child custody proceedings, it's the rules of evidence and the best interest of the minor. And I think that's where we're going. And then it gets the motivation of the inadvertence of the parent out of the question, and it focuses really, I think, on what everyone's concerned about,
how
the best interest of the minor.
Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with that, Mr. Chairman, as long as it's no longer criminal for a parent to hear that conversation.
And I think with the Senate version, Senator, I think that's the result.
I think that gets there.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman. I think we're all interested in the compromise that Mr. Guarnelli has just articulated. Are we competent to consider that and put that in the bill? We can.
Have to do it in two steps.
Right. Yeah, we'll do it.
Then we can get that drafted. We can take a look at it and proceed.
Okay. Max, is that?
Yeah, we'll have to draft it, and if we can, and then I would also suggest we use that same language under the C in the official proceeding, too.
Because we can be limited to three in this meeting here.
Yeah. And, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to work on that over the next hour with
sure.
Representative Gruenberg.
Okay, sure.
And
Mike. Yeah, that's great.
Okay, great.
Let's do that.
Then without further ado, we'll recess.
To call the chair.
Why don't you draft something?
For the record, it's Senator French, Senator Huggin, Representative Gruenberg, and myself, Representative Cott. So we do have a quorum of two members from both sides. We've worked since this morning on an amendment that I'll.
Yeah, we got it.
Everybody's got a copy of it. It seems to be meeting the satisfaction of all the members. So with that.
What a motion?
Motion to adopt the committee substitute with the language that we've agreed to in it.
And the step parent.
Yeah, and step parent.
So moved.
So moved. And hearing no objection, then we're adjourned. And remember, just sign the report. We can be on with business. There.
And here's the report. Here.
We've been joined by Senator Seekins. The language was agreeable to everybody.
It was.
And I think we got a good piece of legislation that does exactly what we all want, and that is to decriminalize.
This is en route once we get into limited powers.
Is this language Tam Cook drafted?
That's correct.
Okay.